Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for August 22nd, 2008. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, a new strategy for developing antibiotics that don't kill bacteria, predicting decisions of undecided voters, and turbulent times for climatologists in the United States. All this and more, plus our usual roundup of stories from our free online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
The number of antibiotics in the drug development pipeline has been declining for some time now. And for the antibiotics out there, a major problem has been bacteria that quickly become resistant to the drugs. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, Vanessa Sparandio and colleagues describe a new strategy for developing antibiotics that both prevents infection and does not promote bacterial resistance. Sparandio says the broad-spectrum antibiotic will be ready for preclinical settings in about 5 years and may be effective against any number of bacterial pathogens that rely on QCC. A conserved membrane histidine sensor kinase that lets the bacteria know it is inside you. I spoke with Sparandio from the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center in Dallas.
What we're describing here is developing a novel type of antibiotic with a new mode of action that seems to work pretty broadly in gram-negative bacteria, and that we are showing here in this manuscript proof of principle that it can work against important pathogens such as E. coli 157, which is responsible for the spinach outbreak, Salmonella typhimurium, which is responsible for the peanut butter recalls, and also lately the jalapeno peppers outbreaks, and also the agent of tularemia, which is considered a biothreat class A agent by the United States.
How does this potential antimicrobial work differently than conventional antimicrobials?
The first difference is this will not kill the bacteria, okay? And this is important when you think about basically engendering less evolutionary pressure towards resistance. So if you have billions of bacteria that are not resistant to a drug, and you have in that population just 10 bacterial cells that are resistant, but you kill the billions that are not resistant, you immediately select very fast for the few 10, the minority in there, that are resistant now to that drug, and they will take over. However, when you're not really trying to kill, you're not engendering such a very strong evolutionary pressure. And what this drug is doing is basically preventing activation of virulence traits. So it's in fact an anti-virulence drug, because it's not trying to kill the bacteria, it's just trying to prevent it from attacking the host, and in this way, not allowing it to cause disease in the host, and at the same time, basically, your immune system can take over and clear it.
What are these virulence traits? Are these genes within the bacteria?
Yes. So those are basically the virulence genes that form the repertoire in the genome of these bugs. They're used basically to produce toxins, to produce adhesins, to allow it to colonize the host, to hijack the host cell, so the cells of the host start working towards the bacteria. In the case of VHEC, which is E. coli, it will engender production of bloody diarrhea, and also, you know, it can cause kidney failure and also stroke. In the case of Salmonella, it can cause gastroenteritis or typhoid fever, which is very systemic and can last for a long time. And in the case of tularemia, it actually causes a very strong systemic disease that basically ends up in septic shock with a mortality rate of 80%.
So what exactly does it mean to block the virulence of a bacteria?
What it means is the drug is binding to the sensor in the surface of the bacteria, QCC. QCC is used by bacteria to respond to stress hormones of the host, such as adrenaline and noradrenaline, which gives the bacteria a very good knowledge of that they are inside of the host versus outside of the host, and also helps it gauge the immune system of the host. So with QCC sensing adrenaline and noradrenaline, the bacteria knows it's in the host, and QCC starts a very complex process in which all of the virulence genes necessary for the bacteria to infect the host are activated. So if you now basically give the drug, and the drug will bind to QCC and will not allow QCC to see its real signals, adrenaline and noradrenaline. So what's going to happen is the bacteria won't be able to know it's inside of the host, and it will just pass through because it will not know where it is. So you're basically blinding the bacteria to the fact that it reached the host. And then what's going to happen is the bacteria will not know where it is, will not express its virulence genes, and in this way, basically, it won't cause disease. And the few bacteria that are there, your immune system can take over and clear the infection. So you basically do not have infection happening.
So the bacteria are still there, still growing. They're just not spreading or taking over, as it were.
Exactly. So the bacteria are still growing because the drug is not killing them.
Now, you mentioned several bacterial pathogens at the beginning. Did you test it against all of these bacteria?
Yeah, we tested against these three that I mentioned. So with E. coli 157 in vitro, which is what we could work, it basically prevented expression of all virulence genes, prevented formation of lesions on epithelial cells, which is how this bacteria causes diarrhea in the intestine. And it also prevented expression of the toxin, which is a very potent toxin that's responsible for the kidney damage and the strokes that this bacterial infections cause. With Salmonella, it was also quite effective, and even in an animal model, we could prevent death by Salmonella infection in about 60% of these animals. And in tularemia, which was the most striking one because this has the best animal model, the one that really mimics human disease, in tularemia, with just one single dose, we could prevent death of 80% of the mice that have been infected with tularemia, while just, 10% of the mice that are infected and not treated survive.
Is the signaling pathway stopping a bacteria from being virulent, is it a possible option for all bacteria or only particular pathogens?
So it's a possible option for the bacteria that actually have this sensor, QCC. So what we find this sensor in gram-negatives, okay? We don't find homologs of this sensor in gram-positives. So it's a possibility for all of the gram-negatives that have QCC. And the reason we actually worked with things like tularemia and E. coli is because tularemia is evolutionarily very different from E. coli. So if we could hit a receptor that was so different in tularemia, chances are we hit things in the middle. And in the middle between E. coli and tularemia, there are very, very important human and plant pathogens that bear this type of receptor. So we think that, there is a good possibility we can get a lot of what's in the middle.
Vanessa Sparandio, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Vanessa Sparandio is senior author of a paper on a new strategy for antibiotic development. Read the paper in this week's Science.
This is Nancy Goff, editor of Science Signaling. We are now accepting original research submissions for publication starting September 2008. The journal formerly known as Science's SDKE is devoted to the topic of cellular signal transduction. To learn more, go to www.sciencesignaling.org.
You might think that you make most of your decisions based on conscious deliberations of the available options, such as choosing who to vote for in an upcoming election. But in a paper in this week's Science, Bertram Goransky and colleagues report that they could predict the decision of 70% of those who indicated they were undecided about a controversial political issue. The prediction was based on testing people's automatic mental associations, or how quickly people responded to and correctly categorized images and words. The results indicate that decision-makers often already have made up their minds at an unconscious level, even when they consciously report they are still undecided. I spoke with Goransky from the University of Western Ontario in Canada.
With a simple or relatively simple reaction time procedure where we just show participants words and pictures, automatic mental associations that we assess with relatively simple speeded response latency tasks, we can predict their future choices regarding important decisions. So if you, for example, take the upcoming election in the United States, there might be some individuals who still haven't made up their mind if they should vote for Obama or should vote for McCain. And so what we could do with this response latency procedure that we've used in our research is that for these yet undecided individuals, we could predict if they would give their vote to Obama or McCain in the upcoming election.
From your team's research, what's an example of how these automatic mental associations predicted future choices of undecided decision makers?
So we had, these were participants in Italy, and it was a controversial debate about an expansion of a U.S. military base in that area. And we had participants from the community come into the lab, and they completed a couple of survey measures, including their beliefs about what they think this expansion of the U.S. military base will do, as well as if they're in favor of the expansion, against the expansion of the military base, or if they're still undecided. And we gave them this response latency procedure that I mentioned that included pictures of the military base and positive and negative words, and they were asked to categorize them as quickly as possible, and we calculated a score of automatic mental associations. Then a week later, we brought participants back into the lab and did exactly the same again. And what we found for those participants who, at the first session, indicated that they're still undecided about the expansion of the U.S. military base, some of them at the later point were in favor, some of them were against, and some of them were still undecided. And what our response latency measure of these automatic mental associations did was it relatively accurately predicted which of our undecided participants were a week later in favor of the expansion, against the expansion, or still undecided. And with the measures that we used, we got an accuracy of roughly 70%. So 70% of our undecided participants were correctly classified as being either against or in favor or still undecided.
So they would associate perhaps positive words, say, with a picture of a larger base. And
yeah. I mean, maybe the task becomes a little clearer if I explain how it works. So participants are asked, like in our study, participants are just presented with positive and negative words, and those could be completely unrelated to the U.S. military base. Could be words like cockroach, fun, party, friend, family, and so on, like positive and negative words. And they're asked to classify those positive and negative words with key presses on a computer keyboard as quickly as possible. So to press a right key when they see a positive word and a left key when they see a negative word. And interspersed with these positive and negative words, on some trials, they see pictures of the U.S. military base. And in one block of the task, participants are asked to respond to the pictures of the U.S. military base with the same key as they respond to with positive words. And in another block of the task, they're asked to respond to the pictures with the same key as they respond to for the negative words. And what we calculate, so there are certain algorithms that help us to consider the speed and the accuracy with which they can quickly respond to those pictures. And what we look at is the relative difference in the mean response latency of the first type of combination compared to the second type of combination. And the assumption is if people have relatively positive associations regarding that U.S. military base, in this case, they would be faster and make less errors when responses to the U.S. military base is paired with positive words than when it is paired with negative words.
Is there any concern that the taking of these automatic mental association tests might bias a person in a particular decision the way subliminal messages are thought to?
Well, technically, one could modify the task so that it is likely to create attitudes or these automatic associations. But since in this task, all possible combinations are balanced, any potential effect of one possible combination would be counteracted by the opposite combination.
Practically speaking, then, how might one employ this knowledge that automatic mental associations predict the conscious choice?
So what we've argued in our paper, and I think that link is probably relatively easy to make, is particularly in a political context. So political scientists and polls often have a hard time in predicting election outcomes if there's a large portion of undecided voters. So the voters who are decided, they can tell you who they're going to vote for a couple of weeks down the road. I mean, some of them may change their mind, but the biggest problem for the polls are those who basically say that they're undecided until the day of the election. And what these tools can do, or what our findings suggest, is that one could possibly improve the prediction of election outcomes with measures such as the one that we have used in our study. I mean, this is not the only measure that is available to assess these automatic mental associations, There are a couple of others. For certain reasons, we had a preference for this particular measure, but we believe that any of the measures that are available could possibly help to at least improve the prediction of election outcomes. I mean, one thing that I should mention, that the measure that we have used is not uncontroversial. So there are still a couple of conceptual and methodological debates about the functionality of this measure and how it operates. But I think our findings clearly suggest that this measure is useful, despite obvious problems with this measure, and that it could possibly be used to improve the prediction of election outcomes.
Well, to the critics, what sort of conscious decisions, if any, could not be predicted using this method of testing automatic mental associations?
I mean, one thing that we, for example, found in our study is that for those participants who indicated during the first session that they're decided, for those, these automatic mental associations didn't do anything.
So this is something only then for people who are undecided?
At least in our study, yes. So here the assumption is that these automatic mental associations have the potential to bias incoming information. However, there is research in other areas, not in the area of decision making, where these measures have shown to influence behaviors that are either relatively difficult to control, or if people are in a situation where it's difficult to control their behavior. So for example, applications in the domain of ethnic or racial prejudice have shown that adaptations of these measures to, for example, the evaluation of faces with black and white skin color can predict people's nonverbal behavior in an interaction of, for example, a white participant with a black participant. And these nonverbal behaviors, those were primarily ones that are relatively difficult to control. So here, the usefulness of the measure goes beyond decision-making processes, but can also help us to understand social interactions between individuals.
Well, Bertram Goransky, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for the interview.
Bertram Goransky is senior author of a paper on how automatic mental associations predict future choices. Read the paper and a related perspective in this week's Science. Also this week in Science, smelling danger. Julian Brechbull and colleagues have demonstrated that the Grüneberg ganglion in mice detects alarm pheromones, which are produced by other mice in distress. For 35 years, scientists have known about the Grüneberg ganglion, which also has been identified in all mammalian species studied thus far, including humans. Still, the function of the Grüneberg ganglion is controversial. In the paper, researchers report that typically a mouse immediately stops moving when exposed to alarm pheromones. But then, when the researchers removed the Grüneberg ganglion from mice and exposed the mice to alarm pheromones, the mice kept wandering about as if nothing was wrong, though they could still smell a cookie hidden in their bedding. Read more about it in this week's Science. Like a lot of science agencies in the United States, the National Center for Atmospheric Research is facing turbulent times because of a budget crunch. The lab is one of three U.S. contributors to the models used by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which updates its report in the coming year and, in turn, affects climate policy around the world. Science News writer Eli Kentish writes about the lab, its budget woes, and the concern that the lab will not be able to meet its deadline for completing its climate simulation.
The premier academic U.S. climate model is in trouble. It's run out of the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Boulder, Colorado. Flat budgets from Congress over the last 5 years have caused the problems, and as a result, climate scientists won't be able to do as much climate research with this model.
What does this model feed into? Why is it important for scientists to have this particular model?
The model is called the Community Climate System Model. It's one of the three biggest climate change global climate models run out of the U.S. It includes components that simulate the atmosphere, the land, the ice, the ocean, all coupled together. And as one of the major models in the U.S., it's used every 7 years or so in the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. That's the body that won a Nobel Prize last year and is really considered the world's premier body on assessing climate change. And so as the premier academic model, CCSM, as they call the model, really represents the best science that U.S. academics can do in partnership with the U.S. government.
How does that compare with the two other models that are done by the U.S.?
The two other models are run by NOAA and NASA. NOAA's the Ocean Agency, and NASA studies space. Those two models are generally respected, but they're done in small groups of government experts. CCSM, it's more reflects the progress of the university community. Hundreds of scientists working in collaboration to try to simulate the Earth as best they can.
Now, you said this happens every 7 years or so. What's changed in the model since the last time it was done?
There are a number of improvements that the modelers want to add to their version of the model. For example, the last version of the model would show El Niño occurring every 2 years. And El Niño, which is a global climate phenomenon that leads to dry or wet winters, El Niño actually happens every 4 to 6 years. And so that was one thing that they couldn't get their model to properly simulate. Another problem is that the model doesn't really include the important contributions to the atmosphere from biological life. The land, as well as the ocean, emit billions of tons of carbon as well as nitrogen, and those elements help form the Earth's climate. And the model didn't simulate them very well. And so these aspects, which are considered biogeochemistry, are among the things that the scientists are trying to add to this year's model.
To the budget woes, then, was there a particular reason that the National Center for Atmospheric Research had these particular budget problems, or was this part of a larger trend of less science funding here in the United States?
The center, which is called NCAR, is among many government science labs, which has seen its funding basically remain flat over the last 5 to 8 years. Congress has said it was going to improve the outlook for science funding, including a promise, I believe, in 2003 to double the NSF budget. NSF is the agency which funds NCAR, this climate lab, but it hasn't happened for a variety of reasons. And since the budget has remained flat, that has meant that scientists haven't been able to hire new replacements. When senior scientists leave, it's meant that the scientists at NCAR have to do more in terms of an increasingly complex model, and they've had to do that more science with fewer people. And it's led to a number of prominent scientists leaving the lab.
And how many scientists have left thus far?
Among their key climate modelers, more or less 14%. Seven top climate change scientists that contribute heavily to CCSM at the lab in the last 2 years.
Well, other than modeling the biogeochemistry, what else is new for these scientists to do? What's a new project?
So one of the new areas of science they're trying to improve with the model is better simulations of clouds, the role of clouds in terms of blocking sunlight, as well as the clouds' role in interacting with aerosols. But at the same time, they're trying to do more with the model. NCAR was trying to do more different kinds of science related to climate. One of those efforts was an effort to grow NCAR into so-called social impacts research in a new and more robust way, which has put pressure on the budget there. For example, the previous director of NCAR, Tim Killeen, wanted to expand NCAR to do social science research related to climate. These were plans that came about around in 2004. It made a lot of sense at the time because social scientists want to contribute to our understanding of how climate change might affect people, societies, economies. But in the end, as a result, they had added administrative costs, and those were dollars with a flat budget that they could have spent on science.
Well, what's happened to this lab, the one created to address the social impacts of climate change?
So the social impacts lab actually was closed in May. It showed that NCAR's leadership realized that with flat budgets, they couldn't do all the new things that they had wanted to do in 2004.
Has that closing of the lab put NCAR back on track?
Well, in terms of climate modeling, NCAR still has to cut from its budget. It's still spending more than it might get. And so, for example, 2 weeks ago, the lab removed a special activity that had been part of the Social Impacts Lab that focused on international impacts of climate change, for example, on developing countries. And so NCAR is also looking for other places where it can cut its budget so that it can focus its energy and money on its core mission, which includes CCSM, its vaunted climate model.
What's next then for the lab, now with a new director as of this past June, right?
The new director, Eric Barron, showed that he's not afraid to remove some parts of the lab to protect these so-called core areas like climate modeling. He cut this effort on international societal impacts I mentioned. He says he'll do more. But in the end, NCAR's fate really rests with Congress. If Congress decides to increase NSF's budget, then NCAR, like the other things which NSF funds, will get a boost, and it can start to hire more people so that they're doing increased amount of science and more complex science with the right amounts of scientists. In the meantime, it's anyone's guess what NCAR's leaders might have to cut in order to allow their core science, like climate modeling, to go forward.
Eli Kentish, thank you very much.
Thanks, Rob.
Science news writer Eli Kentish on the turbulent times for U.S. climatology. Read his article in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's free online daily news site, Science Now, joins us to talk about the latest science news. Hi, David.
Hey, Rob.
So what stories do you have for us today?
Well, Rob, we're going to talk about birds that can recognize themselves in the mirror, which is actually kind of a big deal. We're going to talk about why symmetrical bodies are more attractive. And finally, on a topical note, we're going to talk about a sort of log-chomping Olympics between beavers.
Well, let's start with birds recognizing themselves in the mirror. Why is that such a big deal?
Well, Rob, this story has to do with a behavior known as mirror self-recognition. Now, when you or I look into a mirror, we know that that's not a stranger looking back at us. We know that it's us looking back at us. And this ability has been found in other primates and actually, surprisingly, also in non-primates such as elephants and dolphins. When they see a mirror, they know that it's themselves looking back at them. But most other species don't have this ability. When they see their mirror image, they think it's an enemy and they attack the mirror.
Yeah, these are all mammals so far, right?
These are all mammals so far. And what's interesting about this new study is researchers decide to say, well, what is it about why some species seem to be able to recognize themselves and some species can't? And one clue seems to be that, you know, if we're talking about primates or even elephants or dolphins, these are all social species, animals that live in groups and who may have to empathize with one another at various points during their lives. And so these researchers said, well, maybe it's this quality, this sociability quality that determines whether a species can recognize itself in the mirror.
So they looked at this bird. Which bird?
Well, they looked at a bird called the magpie, and this is a very social bird. And what they did was they took 5 magpies and they put them in cages with mirrors for a little while, and the magpies sort of spent a few minutes, you know, just poking around the mirror and looking behind it, just sort of trying to get a sense of what it was in the first place. And so after the magpies had familiarized themselves with the mirror, they put a color dot right below the magpie's beak, sort of on their chest feathers. And then they put the magpies back in the cages. And lo and behold, as soon as the magpies saw themselves in the mirror, they were able to see this color dot, which they wouldn't have seen otherwise. And they started pecking at it to remove it. So this was pretty conclusive proof that the magpies recognized that they were actually looking at themselves in the mirror.
So it's not necessarily something that has to do with the mammalian brain. This mirror self-recognition is a social construct.
That's what it seems to be, because the mammalian brain and the bird brain are very different. In fact, researchers had thought that this mirror self-recognition was tied to a part of the mammalian brain called the neocortex. But birds don't have this region. So it's not so much perhaps how the brain is wired, but perhaps just how these species live. You know, more social species may just be more prone to recognize themselves in the mirror.
Well, from birds perceiving themselves in the mirror to the human perception of attractiveness, what does symmetry have to do with the perception of attractiveness?
Well, Rob, there have been studies that have been done recently that have shown that the more symmetrical somebody's face is, the more a person of the opposite sex is to find that face attractive. You know, both of your earlobes being the same size and your eyes being at the same level and things like that. And so a group of researchers was wondering, is it just the face or is it the whole body? Are more symmetrical bodies more attractive as well? But this has been a hard question to study.
Why is that?
Well, to study something like asymmetry, you're talking about subtle differences, maybe the difference in the wrist size between the left wrist and the right wrist. And so you sort of need sophisticated imaging to look for these sorts of things. And the scientists in these studies turn to doctors and fashion designers to do their work. And they turn to doctors because physicians sometimes use three-dimensional body scanners to make images, say, of a burn victim's skin. And designers actually also use scanners to make clothing because they want to size the clothing accurately. So they need a very specific dimensions of a person so that the clothing fits them just right.
So they took a known technology and applied it to an unknown question.
Exactly. And for this study, they recruited 40 male and 37 female college students. had them get into the scanner and had the scanner create these three-dimensional representations of what their bodies actually look like without clothes on. And what's interesting about these images that are created is you can't tell somebody's race or skin color or even their hairstyle from these images. So when people see these 3D images, they're only really seeing these body proportions and not much else. So the researchers had about 37 men and 50 women take a look at these images and rate which ones they found more attractive than others. And lo and behold, just like the face studies, the bodies that were more symmetrical were rated as more attractive by the people that viewed these images.
Now, you've brought a couple of these images in with you. Looking at them, it looks as though the one on the left is just thinner than the one on the right.
Right. You can actually check out these images on the site. But if you're looking at this, one of these images, the image that would be viewed more attractive or more symmetrical, it does look thinner. But if you look closely, you will see that the quote-unquote unattractive image, there are some slightly different proportions. If you're looking at, say, the length of the arm or the thickness of the leg, you'll see some slight differences there that you don't see in the quote-unquote more attractive image. So it's not just a question of thinness, it's a question of proportion.
Well, in terms of sexual selection, why would we prefer more symmetry than not?
Well, it's a great question, and it's very controversial. But the speculation has been that if people have some irregularities on one side of their body versus the other side of their body, it could be due to susceptibility to disease. Perhaps you either had a disease that caused part of your body to look different than the other, or something about your genetic makeup makes part of your body look different from the other, and that also may predispose you to certain diseases. But the bottom line is that if either of those is the case, then if you're trying to choose a mate, you want to obviously choose the healthiest mate you can. So if there's a quick way of determining just by looking at somebody if they've had a disease in the past or might have one in the future, something in your brain might say, aha, that person is more or less attractive.
Well, from the competition for most attractive to the competition between beavers, what's the contest here?
Well, Rob, the contest here is between two beavers, the modern beaver and an ancient beaver that lived about 4 to 5 million years ago called Diploides. And the question is, were these ancient beavers as good at chomping wood as today's beavers are? But it's a tough question to answer because obviously these beavers aren't around anymore, so how do you figure it out? Well, a team of researchers came up with a pretty ingenious way of trying to stage a beaver Olympics between these ancient beavers and modern ones. They went to the zoo and observed modern beavers chomp away and take molds of their teeth and things like that. But it was a bit trickier for the ancient beavers. What they had to do was they went to a peat bog that was discovered in the Canadian Arctic in the 1960s. And this bog is full of all this fossilized wood that dates back 4 or 5 million years. And it's very well preserved. And so well preserved, the researchers could actually tell which pieces of log had been chewed by ancient beavers and which ones hadn't. And based on the chew marks, they were actually able to develop metal replicas of what these ancient beaver teeth look like and how they worked. So now they were able to sort of compare head to head.
Or tooth to tooth.
Or tooth to tooth, the abilities of these ancient beavers to modern beavers. And what they find is that modern beavers take the gold in this competition. They just tend to be better chewers of wood. They're much more efficient. They're much faster. And overall, they just do a better job of gnawing through this wood.
What does that mean for these ancient beavers that they're not as adapted at gnawing through wood?
Well, we know that modern beavers build dam and are sort of these expert lumberjacks. And what this study shows us is that the beavers of the past may just not have been as good. And they may not even have built dams in the first place because they just may not have been as skilled with their teeth to be able to do this. And it suggests that there may be differences in their lifestyles as well. So instead of building dams, they might have used other strategies like hibernating in a burrow or a nest. And the authors even speculate that this may be one of the reasons these ancient beavers eventually went extinct, just because they weren't able to control their environment as well as modern beavers can.
Okay. Well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now?
Well, Rob, we're looking into a story about how the faces of ice hockey players may predict how aggressive they are, how shipwrecks can introduce unwanted species into coral reefs, and finally, how ear infections might be linked to obesity. So be sure to check out the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news site of science. You can catch up on the latest science news at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the August 22nd, 2008 Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.